Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Current Perspectives on the Treatment of Colorectal Cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many colorectal cancer organizations and many other cancer-related organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in the program that we have so many of you on the call today. Now, we have over 524 participants on the call today, so it's a very large call. And you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, China, Germany, Ireland, the Philippines, the UK, and Venezuela. So you really come from all over the world. And it is a credit to each of you that you are spending the next hour with us. Now, today's program was made possible by Lilly, Sanofi US, and Regeneron Pharmaceuticals, and an educational donation provided by Amgen. I really want to thank them for their support of our program today. I'd like to take a moment and turn your attention to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about our speakers and the topics that they'll be addressing. There also is information about our collaborating organizations as a resource for all of you. These are free resources for you. There also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. We very much rely on your feedback as we plan future programs, and we are in the midst of planning all the programs for 2014, so the timing could not be better. And so please tell us the topics you'd like us to offer going forth and any other thoughts that you might have about the programs. And also I would say that today's program is one that many of you have requested, and so we very much try to offer the programs that all of you request as much as possible. Really try to do that. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Al Benson III, and Dr. Benson is Professor of Medicine, Associate Director of Clinical Investigations, Robert H. Lurie Comprehensive Cancer Center, Northwestern University. And Dr. Benson is going to provide an overview of colorectal cancer. He's going to discuss the current standard of care and new treatment options and the importance of communicating with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Benson.
Thank you, Dr. Messner, and it's a pleasure to join everyone today. I'd like to touch upon a few important concepts when it comes to treating an individual with colorectal cancer. First of all, I'd like to emphasize that this is very much a multidisciplinary team. In other words, people will benefit from members of the team that could include psychosocial support, nutritional support as examples, but also in terms of treatment, many patients need evaluation by the surgeon, radiation oncologist in the case of rectal cancer, and the medical oncologist. And there have been important advances over the years in terms of surgical technique, as well as the delivery of radiation therapy. Very striking over the past decade or so has been the development of new drugs for the treatment of colorectal cancer. And I'd like to highlight this list of agents briefly. In terms of chemotherapy, there have been two very important drugs that have improved the benefit of therapy for patients. One is the drug irinotecan and the other oxaliplatin. And these drugs are now routinely integrated in our care strategy for individuals. 5-FU is also another chemotherapy drug, which we've had for over 50 years, but it remains a very important component of the treatment of colorectal cancer. And this class of drugs is known as a fluoropyrimidine. And through the years, there's been a development of another fluoropyrimidine known as capecitabine, and this is an oral drug. And we're able to interchange 5-FU and capecitabine in our regimen. So some people would prefer pills in the case of capecitabine. Some would prefer IV in the case of 5-FU. More recently has been the development of what's referred to as targeted or biological drugs. And these are drugs that target specific biological pathways within tumors. One such target is known as the EGFR pathway, and Dr. Saltz is going to be talking about this pathway. And the two drugs that are now available that target the pathway, known as cetuximab and panitumumab. Also, there's another targeted approach, which is referred to an anti-angiogenesis approach. And one cornerstone biological agent for this approach is known as bevacizumab. And this is combined with the chemotherapy drugs that we have available. In 2012, two new anti-angiogenesis agents were approved by the FDA, and they're known as aflibercept and regorafenib. What we also learned during this period of time that anti-angiogenesis may benefit people throughout the course of their treatment for metastatic colorectal cancer. And this is the result of recent clinical trials, which has resulted in changes in terms of how we approach patients and combine chemotherapy. Another concept that's very critical is what we call the continuum of care. And what this does is define upfront what might be the appropriate options for an individual patient. And this is critical because, as you just heard, with these multiple therapies we now have available, there are a variety of combinations and sequences of therapy we can give to patients over the course of their illness for metastatic colorectal cancer. And by doing so, we have improved quality of life and the overall benefit of therapy. And we also have learned that over time, people who actually have access and can receive these multiple agents appear to have the best outcome. And this is very much a strategic, individualized treatment approach, which we utilize to keep people feeling well for as long as possible. Now, in the case of oxaliplatin, we also use this agent combined with either 5-FU or capecitabine for patients who have earlier stage colorectal cancer, particularly stage 3 cancer, where people are able to undergo surgery with complete removal of their disease, and then after successful surgery receive what we call systemic therapy or chemotherapy to help reduce the chance of recurrence. And this has also been an important development. Now, there's also a group of patients with metastatic disease who may have fairly isolated disease, for example, in the liver and lung, who might benefit from surgical removal of these deposits of tumor in the liver or lung. And with the introduction of these new agents and combinations, we've seen that people have experienced improved response rates, and we're able to identify those who might benefit from surgery in this setting. And so one strategy, which we refer to as neoadjuvant therapy, is that we give a limited course of combination chemotherapy followed by further evaluation, and with the surgeon's input, it's possible that at least in some cases, people can go on and have surgical removal of their metastatic disease. After that, we generally give additional chemotherapy, and then when that's completed, carefully monitor patients to make sure there's no further evidence of recurrence. There also has emerged another concept, and this is an area of interest, and we're still exploring this in clinical trials, but what's referred to as conversion therapy. So there are people, for example, who present with metastatic disease, and we don't believe at that moment in time that surgery will be possible. However, with the utilization of combination therapy, we've actually seen individuals who have had a very significant response and have therefore converted, thus the term conversion therapy, to resectability. In other words, we might not have thought the patient could go to surgery initially, but with combination therapy, we are able to accomplish such. Another area after successful treatment is what we refer to as survivorship, and this is another area we are exploring further and how to most appropriately monitor patients over time to make sure that they're not recurring, and if they do recur, to intervene appropriately at that time. And so in terms of treatment guidelines that we have created, not only are we discussing in guidelines how to combine this variety of chemotherapies and biological agents we now have available, but also over what sequence of time would most benefit the individual patient, and then also how do we monitor people and treat any symptoms or recurrences over time. I'd also like to touch base on the cancer care team and the importance of communication. I already mentioned that the care of an individual patient with colorectal cancer really represents a team approach. And this includes a variety of healthcare professionals. I mentioned surgeons and radiation oncologists and medical oncologists, but many people benefit from other services. They may be financial services, social work services, psychological services, and nutrition as important examples. And what we emphasize to our patients is that it's critical across this multidisciplinary approach that each individual and their families are communicating to their healthcare team in terms of particularly how they're feeling, if they're having symptoms. It's just critical that we are aware of symptoms because in many cases, although the symptoms may not seem like a significant development for an individual patient, what it can result in, depending on the symptom, is adjustment in the treatment program. So we frequently have to adjust patients' doses of chemotherapy. We monitor very carefully if patients have symptoms such as diarrhea or early indication of some nerve damage, for example, in the fingers and feet. But this communication is absolutely critical, and healthcare providers are very anxious to hear from their patients and how they're feeling. It's also important to communicate any particular concerns or worries that the individual may have. And certainly if there is not clear understanding of what's going on during the course of treatment, it's important to ask the questions. And as questions come up, whether they're from friends, family, or your own individual questions, to write them down to make sure they're thoroughly addressed with your healthcare team. So that's my very brief summary, and I'll turn this back over to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Benson. That was a really very comprehensive and excellent overview. Thank you, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Leonard Zaltz, and Dr. Zaltz is Chief Gastrointestinal Oncology Service, Head Colorectal Oncology Section, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Dr. Zaltz is going to address KRAS gene, targeted cancer therapies, and the role of personalized medicine, the important role of clinical trials, and controlling symptoms and pain. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Zaltz.
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to have a chance to talk with you today, and it's a pleasure to share this discussion with Dr. Benson. I want to emphasize I agree with everything he said, and I'd really like to emphasize the last point that he touched on, which is the importance of communication with your healthcare team and of feeling comfortable asking questions. What I always try to emphasize to my patients in the first visit is if you remember even a quarter of what we've talked about, you're ahead of the game. There's a whole lot of new information in a very scary setting, and if you remember only one thing, remember it's okay to ask, and it's important to ask. So please understand that that's the way that that doctors and nurses and the rest of us that are taking care of you feel about this. We need to hear from you. There's a lot of confusing terminology that gets thrown around in cancer care and in the world of colorectal cancer. As we get more sophisticated and try to more accurately select the right drugs for the right people, the terminology gets that much more complex. One of the areas that I think there's a lot of confusion about is the question of the gene KRAS, K-R-A-S. And to explain this, We're often, when we talk about genes, you think about that which you may have inherited from your parents and which you can pass on to your children. Those are genes in your body. What we're talking about when we discuss KRAS is a gene in your tumor, in your cancer. And that gene can develop a mutation as part of the cancer and has nothing to do with what's going on in the rest of your body. So when we talk about a KRAS mutation, we're referring to a mutation in a gene named KRAS that's in your cancer. Now, what does this mean? Why do we concern ourselves with this? KRAS is a gene that codes for an important protein by the same name. And that protein is part of the pathway by which signals that come to the cancer cell that tell it to grow and divide and survive and do all kinds of things that we don't want cancer cells to do get transmitted to the nucleus of the cell, which is where the signals get put into action. And so if there is a mutation in KRAS, what that means is that the signaling pathway is stuck in the on position. And regardless of what's going on outside the cell keeps getting told to grow, divide, survive, and do all those bad things. So in general, when we have somebody with a KRAS mutation, it tells us something about how the tumor developed, but more importantly, it tells us about certain drugs that we might use. Dr. Benson referred to two drugs, one called cetuximab and one called panitumumab. These are both targeted agents. You may know them by their brand names, Erbitux and Vectibix. They're two different drugs made by two different companies that are really very, very much alike, and in my opinion, can be used interchangeably. It's not a situation where we would use one and then the other. For the most part, we select and use either one or the other. But what we've learned is that by understanding the target that these drugs hit and understanding how that works, KRAS has to be normal for these drugs to work. And so it has now become part of standard practice when a person has metastatic colorectal cancer that we evaluate in that cancer whether the KRAS gene is normal or mutated. The fancy genetic term for normal is wild type. So you sometimes hear about a wild type KRAS. That's just a normal or a non-mutated KRAS. If KRAS is normal, then these drugs, panitumumab, cetuximab, might work. It's not a guarantee that they will work, but it puts us into a range where there's a reasonable chance that they will work, and it makes sense to try. If the KRAS gene is mutated, then we know virtually with certainty that these drugs will not work. And what they will do is they'll still give patients the side effects. And so we certainly don't want to expose people to drugs that don't have a chance of helping. Now, Dr. Benson referred to the continuum of care and the idea that when we start with a patient, we're thinking many different moves down the road. We're thinking, what's our first treatment going to be? What's our backup plan for that treatment? And what's our backup plan for the backup plan? The use of these drugs, cetuximab or panitumumab, is likely to be in one of those plans for our patient. And so even though I personally rarely use either one in my initial treatment of a patient, I use one or the other in most of my patients with metastatic colorectal cancer. And so I want to know early on whether or not these drugs are something that we should be thinking about in our plans. And so we get the KRAS information and share that with our patients as soon as we know it, which is usually within a few weeks of sending off the test, so that we can know now whether or not these drugs are going to figure into our thinking down the road. Now, recently, we've learned that some other mutations that may occur in the cell, one called NRAS and other types of KRAS mutations, also can be used to identify tumors that won't respond to these drugs. And so that is now moving its way into standard practice so that we're getting more selective of the drug and giving it to a more limited population of patients, but a population of patients that has a higher chance of benefit, and we're sparing people that don't have a realistic chance of benefit from the drug the side effects. And so with that, we're getting more sophisticated, and that would fall into the heading of predicting response to treatment. Part of predicting response is predicting absence of response, because nobody wants to get a drug that doesn't work. And if we knew in advance that a drug wasn't going to work well for our patient, we wouldn't give it. So KRAS and NRAS and that sort of genetic testing is allowing us to predict which patients won't benefit from these particular drugs so that we don't expose them and move on to other drugs. Unfortunately, we don't have tests that allow us to be quite as elegant in terms of selecting patients with the other drugs that we use routinely, the drugs that Dr. Benson mentioned, the 5-fluorouracil, the capecitabine, irinotecan, oxaliplatin, bevacizumab, aflibercept, regorafenib. These are all drugs that are part of our toolbox, part of our thinking as doctors in terms of how are we going to use which drugs for which patients. We hope that in the near future, we will have tests that allow us to know which drugs are going to be most useful for which patient, but right now we don't. Now, I do believe we still can personalize medicine by talking to people in advance about who they are, what side effects matter to them more or less, and in that respect, we can figure which drugs to use first. For example, oxaliplatin is a drug that causes a numbness or tingling in the hands and feet. It may interfere with fine motor skill, and it may interfere with working outdoors in the cold because it creates a cold sensitivity. So if those are issues that are going to matter to a patient, that's a drug that we may move down in the continuum and use other drugs up front. Irinotecan is a drug that we could use up front instead. That drug doesn't cause these neurologic symptoms, but it's more likely to cause hair loss. Now, hair loss may be unimportant in some people's minds and very important in other people's minds. There's not a right-wrong answer there. It's a matter of discussing with each individual patient what's important to him or her and then helping to make selections on that basis. What we don't yet have in the world of colorectal cancer is the ideal type of personalized medicine that we would love to have and hope to have one day, whereby we could send the tumor off for sophisticated laboratory tests and get definitive answers on which drugs will work and which drugs will not. There are a lot of tests that are being advertised out there, and I fear that they create some false hope in people's minds because in reality, they're not reliable enough for us to use in terms of patient care. So right now, if somebody says, I can take your tumor and tell you which drugs will work and which drugs won't, I'm very skeptical of that. The data that are available don't support that that's the case. And at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, we don't use such testing in terms of selecting drugs for our patients because we simply feel it doesn't yet have the ability to do what it says it does. Now, within that context, I wanted to talk with you a little bit about the role of clinical trials. Clinical trials are how we make progress and how we make the cancer care that we have today better for tomorrow and beyond. And in clinical trials, what we do is we first very carefully develop our studies so that they are reasonable for patients to be on. We don't want to be reckless. We want to be very, very aware that everyone that goes on a clinical trial is a patient, is a human being, is not a laboratory subject. And there are human rights committees called institutional review boards at every center that does clinical trials that carefully reviews the studies to make sure that patients' rights are adequately protected and that patients are fully informed of all the potential risks and benefits of a clinical trial. You can never be part of a clinical trial without your knowledge, and you can never be part of a clinical trial without your specific permission. So you never have to worry that you're part of someone's study and you don't know what and you don't know it, and you never have to worry if you're on a study that there's an agenda that you are unaware of. That would be both unethical and illegal. So most academic centers offer clinical trials for patients. What I try to do when I see a patient is first discuss what I believe would be the best standard practice outside of a clinical trial. And then if we have a clinical trial that would be worth a patient's consideration, we discuss that option and discuss the risks and benefits. So I would encourage you to always speak with your doctor about whether or not a clinical trial makes sense for you and what clinical trials are available in your area. The last issue that I was asked to touch on in discussions today is the issue of symptom and pain control. And this goes back to where I started speaking, which is first and foremost, if you have symptoms, if you have pain, discuss them with your healthcare team, discuss them with your doctor, discuss them with your nurse. Make sure that the people who are best in position to help you know what the problem is. One of the things that I believe we're very good at in cancer care is symptom management and pain management. But we can't do it unless we understand what the problem is and unless we have very good communication back and forth. For minor problems, most oncologists are very comfortable dealing with pain medications and various maneuvers on their own. For anything that's beyond the simple stuff, most cancer centers now have specialists who focus on pain and symptom management who can be brought in to assist your doctor and facilitate taking care of you so that we make sure that the newest technologies, the best options, and all of the possible considerations are brought to bear in each individual case. So with that, I think I'm going to stop and want to make sure that we have plenty of time for questions. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Saltz. That was really an excellent presentation and very lots of information for everybody. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next presenter is Diana Bearden, and Diana is a registered dietitian. She supervises clinical nutrition at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Bearden is going to address nutritional concerns and tips, and I'm going to turn this program over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. My goal is to discuss tips for managing side effects you may experience during your treatment that can impact your nutrition. First off, I want to just say that eating well during your treatment can provide you the energy to do the things you enjoy, as well as maintaining your weight and lean muscle mass. Patients who maintain good nutrition tend to tolerate treatments better and have faster recovery from side effects. Excessive weight loss can cause treatment delays, breaks in treatment, and slow the healing process. By meeting nutritional goals during your treatment, maintaining your weight, and preserving your lean muscle mass, these are all key components in accomplishing the goal. Nausea and vomiting, decrease in appetite, taste changes, mouth sores, diarrhea, and constipation, along with fatigue, are common challenges experienced that may pose as barriers to meeting your nutritional goals. My goal is to go ahead and walk through some tips for managing these common side effects to help meeting your nutritional goals. Nausea and vomiting and poor appetite. For example, ways to address these issues can be as simple as eliminating offending odors. It may be helpful to focus on foods that are cold rather than hot. They carry less odors, and a lot of times it's just the smell of food that can trigger a patient to feeling nauseous or losing their appetite. So focusing on blander foods if you're feeling nauseated, such as dry crackers, toast, and avoid overly sweetened foods and those that are fried or greasy or highly seasoned can help with tolerance as well. To address issues with poor appetite, we encourage patients to focus on taking in small, frequent meals, and the foods during these meals being of high calorie and protein value. Eliminating stress during your meal times can also be helpful. So I know that's kind of a challenge whenever you're going through treatment. A lot of times you're running from one appointment to another, if not just in a local setting, but you may be traveling as well. So taking time to eat when the stress level is less than others is optimal. Exercising as much as you can tolerate and it's allowed by your physician can also help. Exercise can help stimulate your appetite. It can also help improve digestion. So even if all you're able to do is walk, which is fantastic, then that's fine. That in itself can be very beneficial. A change in taste is also a possibility, and they can be a little, they can be more unique based on the type of treatment that you're taking. But keeping good oral hygiene is encouraged. Trying to rinse your mouth with a little bit of water and baking soda can cleanse the palate. But taste changes can also happen from the direction of the food tasting different than it usually does, or you may have just a baseline taste in your mouth, so it can go either way. So oral hygiene is a good place to start. A common flavor that patients tend to experience is a metallic-y taste, and one thing we encourage patients to try and do is switch from their metal utensils to plastic. Avoid drinking out of anything that's in a can or getting anything out of the can. Rather, drinking out of a glass container and then getting it from a bottle or a tap itself can be helpful. But to enhance a dull taste, a lot of times patients will say everything tastes like cardboard or nothing has any taste. Interestingly enough, tart flavors such as pickles or lemons or something that's in vinegar can help stimulate the taste buds. And when I've talked with patients, it's interesting, they may not taste anything, but our foods may not taste like they're supposed to, but the one thing that always tends to taste like it's supposed to are citrus. And so I always tell patients to at least try something if that's tolerated. It's also interesting to try foods that you normally don't like. Sometimes foods that you enjoy have a weird taste, but foods that you didn't like before may be welcome. So opening up your options a little bit might be helpful. If you're experiencing mouth sores, definitely be cautious about what you're eating. You want to choose foods that are soft and moist, easy to swallow, and don't require a lot of chewing. You want to avoid anything acidic or tart or spicy that could irritate your mouth. Cutting foods into small bites, or sometimes just pureeing your regular meal until your tolerance is improving can be an option. Using supplement drinks as needed is another way to get some of your calories and protein and vitamins in. We really encourage trying foods first and then the supplements as a secondary option, but they're definitely something to supplement a diet with, not to just have it be your complete diet if we can get other things tolerated. It's important to drink plenty of fluids to prevent dehydration, and a lot of times just staying hydrated. If we're dehydrated, you can have an experience of dry mouth, and that can even cause some taste changes as well. So getting enough fluid in throughout the day is key, is something else we need to remember. A change in bowel function may also be an issue. A lot of times patients tend to switch back and forth from constipation to diarrhea at times, or sometimes they just experience one throughout their treatment based on whatever their program is. But constipation can be caused by a change in your diet, pain medications, a decrease in activity, or a side effect from the disease or process itself. Increasing fluid, sometimes fiber, depending on what the cause is, and activity can definitely be beneficial. But talking with your team about this is important because it can be caused from a lot of things, and they may need a different approach just based on what the actual issue is. Another thing, if you're experiencing diarrhea, is always stay hydrated. When we have diarrhea, we lose not only electrolytes but fluid, and replacing that is important. Sometimes adding soluble fiber to your diet can be helpful, eating small meals. But then talking with your healthcare team is important because based on the rationale for or the cause for the diarrhea will determine the intervention. So it's not a blanket answer, so definitely be in communication. Lastly, just to touch on fatigue, again, fluid is going to be brought up. Dehydration can result in fatigue, and so getting enough fluid in throughout the day is very important. I can't, stress that enough. Also, getting in the nutritional needs, we need to view nutrition as our fuel and what keeps our body going. And if we're decreasing with that, with the intake, then your body is not having the same energy it needs. But we want the food to be beneficial. We want to focus on foods that are healthful. So talking with your dietitian, your medical team about where to start, how to focus your efforts to meet these goals is the best key. Also, the sooner the better. Don't wait until you've suffered for several days or weeks even before reaching out, because sometimes it can be a simple intervention can really make a difference. I hope this has been helpful, and this concludes my thoughts. I'm going to go ahead and hand it back to Carolyn.
Well, thank you so much, Diana. That was really excellent, and a lot of very helpful tips, and also just very important tips around preventing dehydration, which is so important, as well as maintaining nutrition. So thank you. Very, very excellent. And our next speaker is Elizabeth Ezra. Elizabeth is an oncology social worker. She's program coordinator at Cancer Care. And Ms. Ezra is going to address the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care and the important role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my colleague, Elizabeth Ezra.
Thank you, Carolyn. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with colorectal cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how cancer care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care's program include individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help and some limited financial assistance, as well as chemo copay assistance, are provided by licensed master's level social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a colorectal patient support group over the phone as well as online, and a general telephone and online support group for caregivers. We also have unique young adult caregiver support groups as well. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our Hope Line at 1-800-813-4673 or visit on our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find a lot of additional information on your cancer diagnosis and the treatments you need to receive. As we have learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and get your arms around. Both doctors gave a lot of information, and they also stressed communicating with them and the whole team. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your family. Your social worker can help you prioritize and actually rehearse the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and the information that you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Well, thank you very much, Liz. That was a wonderful presentation and lots of information about how to access services at Cancer Care. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions. And we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And I just want to say up front that if for some reason we don't get to your question or you think of a question tomorrow or a week from now, please call the Cancer Care 800 number 1-800-813-HOPE, and our social work staff are here, and they will address your questions and help you get answers. But for right now, let's see how many questions we can take. So if you would bring all of our speakers on board, Stephanie, and you could explain to them how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Jacqueline Kay. Your line is open.
Thank you. I have a question for Dr. Benson specifically regarding neuropathy in the hands and feet. Are there any of the chemo drugs that are more prone to cause that? And then is that permanent? Is it sort of the gift that keeps on giving as you get into remission? Thank you.
Well, that's a great question, Jacqueline. That's
well,
really it, issue.
Yes, it's very important, and it's one of the symptoms we must monitor for people who receive oxaliplatin. So of all the new drugs that we've developed for colorectal cancer, it's oxaliplatin that can cause what's referred to as peripheral neuropathy, which is this tingling or numbness, particularly of the fingers and toes. What we've learned is that this can be reversible. It can take many, many, many months to reverse, but it is not always reversible, and there are individuals who are left with permanent numbness and tingling. And so our current recommendations is that for many individuals, we have to discontinue the oxaliplatin at the first sign of these symptoms so that the symptoms do not progress. And unfortunately, the symptoms can get worse for a while even when the drug is stopped. So it's very important to recognize this toxicity. We also have a strategy that a number of oncologists use where perhaps people will receive the combination of oxaliplatin and 5-FU maybe for 6 cycles, and then if things are going well, to drop the oxaliplatin, which will reduce the chance of neuropathy. But then if there are signs that perhaps the disease would benefit from a reintroduction of oxaliplatin, we can add it back at that time. But the bottom line is it's important for patients to let us know at the very first sign.
Excellent. And Dr. Saltz, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think Al covered it very well. I just mentioned, unfortunately, we really are limited in what we can do to treat the neuropathy. And so really the hallmark of good, careful care is trying to head it off as early as possible. And as Al alluded to, we've learned over time to ask questions and pull back on the drug early, because the worst neuropathy often is 2 to 3 months out.
And I have to say, we've done some workshops on neuropathy with the NS. I think people have mentioned here with the palliative care with people with pain and symptom management personnel, physicians, as well as with rehabilitation medicine. So for those of you on the call for whom you are struggling with neuropathy, it's very important to bring those symptoms to your treating healthcare team, who can bring in that, I think the multidisciplinary team has been mentioned here, to help you to cope with it, because it is it can be quite difficult to cope with. I don't know if there are any tips that either Dr. Benson or Dr. Saltz would like to offer people in terms of just dealing with the day-to-day issues of having neuropathy, where so many people on the call may actually have not had the benefit of having the treatment stopped or started, and so may actually have significant neuropathy, in terms of members of the team that can be particularly helpful with that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, we don't have great drugs to help this, but we do try some agents like Neurontin to see if it will help individuals. If people are finding that they're stumbling because their feet are numb, we do encourage people to work with physical therapists so that they're able to walk appropriately. Len,
I think the risk of stumbling and falling is one of the biggest concerns that I have for patients, and people just need to be aware of it and honest with themselves. And that is something where physical therapy can sometimes be helpful in at least giving them coping strategies to protect themselves. I am unfortunately very disappointed with any drug therapy for trying to treat the neuropathy, except in those rare patients where it's an overtly painful neuropathy. That's where drugs like Neurontin, Lyrica, Cymbalta can actually be helpful. Those drugs are routinely used in other types of painful neuropathy, but the numbness and tingling that is the hallmark of oxaliplatin neuropathy most of the time is caused in different nerve fibers, and those fibers aren't really affected by those drugs. So unfortunately, prevention is our best shot, and treatment is something we're not up to the task. There had been thoughts previously that using calcium and magnesium in advance might help, but now we've got, unfortunately, very convincing data that those maneuvers don't really help patients.
So that's very helpful to hear then, Dr. Saltz, that actually for people who are now currently in treatment, that's a very important thing to discuss with their team, to really be upfront, not to kind of not discuss that symptom because they're concerned that the oxaliplatin will be removed from treatment. Is that correct? And some people might not be concerned about.
You know, one of the things that's important is let's separate two separate circumstances. Treating metastatic unresectable disease from people getting treatment after resection of stage 3 disease. In this metastatic setting, what is a very common practice and what I personally regard as standard practice is what's called an OptiMox strategy. And this is based on studies done in France by the team that developed the FOLFOX regimen. And they showed that if the plan is to give the oxaliplatin for the first 3 months and then stop the oxaliplatin and continue treating with the other drugs, that controls the neuropathy to a much greater degree without compromising the effectiveness of the treatment. And so when we use that strategy, it's really important for us as doctors to discuss it with patients up front so that they understand that that's the plan. Otherwise, it can be very unsettling when a doctor comes in after 3 months of therapy and says, your scan looks great, now we're going to take a drug away. People get very, very, very uncomfortable with that. So understanding that that's part of a standard practice is useful. In the adjuvant setting, which Dr. Benson referred to earlier, when people are getting drugs after a potentially curative operation, the original standard studies were done with 12 treatments over 24 weeks. And at the time, based on how often we treated patients with the older drugs, that made perfect sense. What a lot of us are finding is that few, if any, patients can really handle 12 doses of oxaliplatin in a row without developing significant neuropathy. And so it's very, very rare in my practice that I give all 12 doses of the oxaliplatin, but I do give all 12 doses of the other drugs. So again, it's a matter of having an ongoing dialogue with the patients, looking for early signs of neuropathy, not waiting until a patient says, now it's really bothering me, because then we may have waited too long.
So that open discussion is really important. Okay, thank you. And our next question?
Our next question comes from Mr. Emil S. Your line is open.
I had prostate cancer, and I just recently had a colonoscopy and had precancerous polyps removed during the colonoscopy. Can these polyps ever develop into malignant tumors? And is there anything other than diet and exercise that I can do to avoid colorectal cancer, knowing that I've had polyps in the past?
Well, that's an excellent question, Emil. Thank you for that question. Dr. Saltz, do you want to address that question?
Sure. Well, first of all, what you've had in my mind is a successful colonoscopy. The purpose of doing colonoscopy is not to find cancer. And if you do a colonoscopy and don't see anything wrong, well, that's reassuring, but it didn't fix the problem. When you find a polyp, what you found is a place where cancer might start if left alone. And by removing that polyp, you've solved the problem because that polyp is no longer inside of you. So that particular polyp has been dealt with successfully. Some polyps will never become cancer, but cancers start in polyps. And so by removing the polyps, we remove the risk of the cancer there. The problem, of course, is that when people develop a polyp, they may be at greater risk for developing additional polyps, and that's why it will be important to have follow-up colonoscopies at appropriate time periods. Often, if polyps larger than a centimeter are found, then a repeat colonoscopy should be done in a year. If they're very, very small polyps, then once every 3 years may be adequate. But what I would say to someone saying I had polyps found at colonoscopy is, good job, sir, because you've protected yourself in the way that we would most like to see happen and just need to keep it up.
That's really excellent.
And we should stress most polyps don't become cancerous, but what Dr. Saltz mentioned is critical.
So should we say anything more just about, for those people like Emil who are concerned about just family members who might be listening to the call who are just concerned about just screening for colorectal cancer? Is this a chance to say a few words about that?
Well, I think it's important to follow screening guidelines, which for average risk people start at age 50. It's also critical that people know their family history because although it's not common in terms of the overall population of people with colorectal cancer, colorectal cancer can be inherited. And so knowing your family history is absolutely important.
Yeah, I would just emphasize that guidelines, which make perfect sense to me, are that every man, woman, and child at the age of 50 should get a colonoscopy. And if one is at or over that age and hasn't, then that needs to be corrected. If we did that kind of screening, then this would become a relatively rare disease, and that would be a beautiful thing. When a person has colorectal cancer, there is a certain amount of increased risk conferred on their first-degree blood relatives. And so it's important to identify who are the parents, brothers, sisters, and children of the person with colorectal cancer, and what are their ages, and screen them appropriately. Usually we recommend screening at least 10 years younger than the identified case. So if somebody were to develop colon cancer at a typical age of, say, 65 or 70, then age 40 would be the appropriate screening age, age 50, rather, would be appropriate screening for the general population, but we say 10 years younger for first-degree relatives, so age 40. If somebody develops it at a younger age still, we say 10 years younger than the age that we knew about.
Okay, excellent. Thank you. And our next question?
Our next question comes from Scotty B. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. Could one of you speak to the HIPEC procedure as a part of the continuum of care, I guess, for treatment of metastatic colon cancer?
Dr. Benson, can you address that?
Yes, I think we, in general, view that approach as one that should be evaluated in a clinical trial. I personally do not consider it a standard of care. Dr. Saltz and I help develop the guidelines for colorectal cancer through the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, and we do not include this as a recommendation of therapy. There are circumstances for a spectrum of diseases known as pseudomyxoma peritonei where selectively that might be useful, but with colorectal cancer, we cannot consider it a standard of care. Dr. Saltz may have further comment.
Dr. Saltz?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. It's something that I know there's lots of talk about. There are certainly people at major centers who feel very enthusiastic about it. I don't feel that the data support its use as a routine standard practice. We do not do it at our center as part of routine care. We have recently opened a clinical trial where it is the experimental arm of a trial because we would like to know. I would point out that, and I guess we should step back and explain for those on the line that aren't familiar with the terminology, HIPEC is heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy, and so it's for people that have a very specific pattern of cancer spread where the tumor is just on the lining of the inside of the abdomen. And what happens is a surgeon does an open procedure to remove as much cancer as possible. It's only useful when virtually all of the cancer can be removed. In that case, heated chemotherapy is put directly into the abdomen in the operating room. The idea of using heat to fight cancer is one that's been around for 50 or 60 years and hasn't really panned out. This is sort of the one last area where it's still being considered. So I think it's important to understand that this is an example of the type of thing where you're going to see a lot of conflicting information, a lot of conflicting opinions, at least my opinion is it's not a proven therapy and not something I regard as standard practice.
Well, thank you. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been outstanding today, and I really provide a lot of information to everyone. I also want to thank all of you who've been who've asked such great questions on the call today, and I also really helped to expand the call today, and I hope that you got information that you can take back to your treating healthcare team so that you can use that information tailored to your particular needs. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening. I want to remind you that this is a one-hour workshop and that in planning this program, we know that you have so many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so I just want to remind all of you about all the services that you can access from Cancer Care. And those services include just a host of services, and we have a staff of 35 oncology social workers who are here to provide support and counseling to you, just to talk to you, actually, to talk to you on the phone. You can email us as well. Whatever system works for you, we really are here to talk to people to help them. We also offer support groups on the telephone and online, and for many people that's very convenient, and especially when you're in areas that it's hard to travel from one place to the next, or even when you're in an urban area and it's just you're busy and you just don't have the time to go to a group and it's just easier to do it on the phone or online. We also provide practical and financial assistance, which is a big area right now for people just figuring everything out, and our staff are very good at that, and we do actually provide financial assistance with help with transportation and home care and child care, so we offer specific types of financial assistance to people as well. And we also offer these workshops, and we also have many publications that you can access from us. Perhaps most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone on this call to leave the call feeling like you're alone. I know that often it's a feeling that people have when they have cancer, that they feel that they're all by themselves and there's no one else to be there for them. I want you to know that you're now part of this community of support, and we are simply a telephone call away. And please do call us or email us, whatever works best for you. And again, our telephone number is 1-800-813-HOPE. And I also want to say something just about this time of year. As the holidays are starting to be talked about and all of that, and people particularly feel that they have lots of questions and concerns. This is a very good time to connect up, to ask those questions to an organization, to call us at Cancer Care about the holidays and how you plan to handle them and what you want to do, what will work best for you. So we invite you all to really take advantage of the services here. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.